You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the pandemic is over. That's right. You heard it here first. I am declaring the pandemic over. Who am I? I'm your host, Justin Mlodzieski, and I'm just a guy. I'm not Dr. Fauci. I don't belong to the World Health Organization. I'm just a guy. But from where I'm looking, from where I'm sitting, staring at my computer as the audio file and the audio waves appear on my screen as I talk, the pandemic is over. We'll get into that some more as we get into the show. But first, I have to introduce my co-host. Joining me from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, and that's a lot of privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Justin, you're the original legendary Polish power, but we saw some legendary Polish power last night watching some UFC.
I'm not the original legendary Polish power. That is Ivan Putski. He was a little bit older than me, but yes, there is a long history of, and I would like to point this out, there is a long history of Polish strength and intelligence. I won't go into the intelligence thing, but strength-wise, watch The World's Strongest Man. Go back and watch The World's Strongest Man. There's a lot of Polish guys on there.
Well, this guy, Ian, I'm not going to attempt to say his last name, was pretty technical, especially with the wrestling. So, Justin, you'll have to watch the highlights. I know you were busy with your own wrestling coaching, so you probably didn't get to catch it, but it was a pretty good fight.
Yeah, I didn't get to catch it, but you hyped it up for me pre-show, so I'm definitely going to check out the highlights because, like I said, intelligence-wise, not surprising me that a Polish fighter would be very, very technical. So
yeah, it was really a chess match the first two rounds. You know, just, you know, if you're not into boxing, it probably looked pretty boring, but it was just a lot of testing and, you know, positioning and, you know, feeling around. And then by the last two rounds, he just managed to get him on the ground. And that was, you know, it wasn't like, you know, you definitely could tell they were evenly matched, but, you know, one was definitely stronger than the other.
Well, yeah, and it's the same thing in wrestling, right? It's the high-level matches can seem pretty boring because there's not a lot of scoring. Like, I mean, our 195, our senior lost 3-0, but, you know, the first two rounds were 1-0 because on their feet, they're in there, they're locking up, they're grappling for position, and they're looking for angles. And you're trying to move the other guy to just get him to move in one direction slightly. And I'm even doing it as I'm talking right now, because it's just that slight opening, that slight movement. And that's what happens when you get to the high level, when both are so technically proficient and proficient with their feel. It looks like nothing's going on, but there's actually a lot going on because they're just trying little things and the other person's countering so quickly and it's so fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what's going on with you? What's going on with your puppy?
Well, things are going good. We're focusing on the crate training. And so he's spending some time away from me, which is good for him. You know, the first week was just all new environment. I didn't want to mix anything in. So hopefully he stays quiet for the whole podcast. But he's downstairs snoozing right now. He got to play with... He just had his first rounds of shots, so he's playing with a couple of select dogs that are trying to limit his interaction with other dogs until he finishes all his vaccines. But he got to play yesterday with a friend of mine's dog and had a lot of fun. Got to run. There was we snuck into a schoolyard and let them run because no dogs were over there. No dogs are over there ever. So it was good to let him just run and chase a ball and do all those things. So it's fun, man. He is definitely going to be a handful because he's very smart. This morning during his playtime, he brought like several leaves inside and started just like fascinated by breaking them apart. So I have a lot of sweeping to do after the podcast.
Well, I think we all have a lot of sweeping to do because we're heading into spring. Right now, that's awesome that you have a new puppy and you have all these new experiences, because it's sort of appropriate to what's going on in the world. The world is kind of heading into a rebirth. Let's talk about that in Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. Does life really suck? Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope that this is making some sense. I hope that you throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. As always, if you would like to support the show, you can do so by Patreon or Locals. Patreon is per episode. Locals is per month. We appreciate any and all support, including affirmations. You can do so at themidside.com/Patreon or themidside.com/Locals. William, I don't know about you, but for me personally, the biggest thing that I think will affect all of our lives that happened this past week is Governor Abbott, the governor of Texas, coming out and opening up the state 100% and getting rid of the mask mandate.
Yeah, I think there was a meme going around, Republicans praise the governor for removing unconstitutional mandates. And it's great. It's great news. Be nice to, get some precedent to make them, have the courts recognize them as unconstitutional, but maybe I'm asking for too much. I think it's going to put pressure on other states. I mean, it already has put pressure on other states. You hear other states talking a little more about reopening. Of course, in California, we still have our completely arbitrary and unachievable standards for reopening. So we'll probably be wearing masks until, 2030.
We'll get into California in a second, because I do think something happened in California that shows that there are cracks in the facade, cracks in the facade of California. But as far as this whole Texas thing, first of all, I want to be clear that Florida did this first, right? Florida did this first. If you look at the past fall, Governor DeSantis said that, Florida's open and you can't be punished or fined for not wearing a mask. So then we enter into this interesting stage, and now Texas is entering into this stage. And I think everybody has to enter into this stage of how compliant do we want to be with the masks? And it's private companies have to deal with that. And we as individuals have to deal with that. And that's the biggest thing for me now, is how compliant do we want to continue to be with these masks? We're told they make a difference. I don't believe they make a difference. I don't think the science shows they make a difference. So do we want to continue wearing them to make it look like we care? Because, and this is something that I think speaks to what you just said about the Republican meme, I don't want to make this Republicans against Democrats. I don't want to make this a left versus right issue, because this is a freedom issue. This is an individuality issue. And a lot of the defense Republicans were using was, and even libertarians were using was, oh, the state shouldn't mandate this, but people will still behave rationally and wear masks. So even though they were celebrating the fact that government wasn't enforcing it, they were still accepting the premise of this is the right thing to do. And the over-the-top ridiculousness about this for me, William, was that not only is this government enforcing something, but it's something to me that doesn't make sense logically. So it was like a double whammy. It was like, here's government oppressing us for something that makes no fucking sense. So now we've moved past government oppression of this, in Texas and Florida and other states, but now we're self-oppressing because we've ultimately accepted, what do we call it? The death premise, the idea that life is scary.
Life is the avoidance of death.
Right.
Yeah. So two things come to my mind, Justin, and I'm still kind of trying to think of how they're connected. And I think they probably are, but the first one is, it's great that the mandates are gone, but if you're a YouTuber in Texas, you're still not allowed to talk about the science of not wearing masks, right? Like those things get removed from YouTube, right? And Twitter and other places, right? Like you can't talk about like the effectiveness of masks or bring up those sort of issues, they just, you know, those aren't allowed on the platform. So we still have some issues societally, right? Again, I'm not calling for government action here. I'm just saying there's still issues societally, right? Like there's this, it is a taboo, right? It's a societally enforced taboo to bring up contrary evidence. The other thing it connects to in my mind is something from the way back machine. Remember the whole North Carolina bathroom law, right? And this was during the Obama administration. All these companies decided, you know, basically the North Carolina had this bill that said, hey, for public spaces, you know, your biological sex is in public spaces is determined which bathroom you can go to, and accommodations will be made in public spaces for public employees that are transgender, and protecting private companies to do whatever they see fit in that space. And that law was heralded as anti-transgender, right? That, you know, something that was like a reasonable compromise, was hailed as anti-transgender, and all those companies pulled out, right? They're threatened to pull out. PayPal, I think, pulled out of a North Carolina investment, and then all these other companies, Virtue Signaled, and I think San Francisco and a couple, maybe New York, all said.
Wait, can we call the pullout method the Virtue Signal method? Sorry,
we can. You know, they all pulled out, right? And North Carolina, I think New York and San Francisco both barred their public employees from traveling to the state for any business that wasn't an emergency. I can't think of an emergency reason to go to North Carolina if you live in San Francisco, but whatever.
I've gone too long without NASCAR.
But you know, so all this happened, right?
The Carolina Panthers play,
and I can't help but think it's also the reason I think that connects is because, or why it connected in my brain is because, you know, from what you were just saying, where it's one thing to not have the mandate anymore, but then there's still this societal pressure that needs to be overcome, right? I don't know when, even if the mandate ended tomorrow here in California, how many customers would not come to my store, for example, if the employees weren't wearing masks, even if they were all vaccinated, right?
Right. I think the connection that you're struggling to make is, and I'm going to quote Batman versus Superman here, in a democracy, good is a conversation. And there is this urge, this tendency in today's culture to shut down conversation, even if the government is not shutting it down. Yeah. Right. And this is where a lot of the conversation has come in about, or a lot of the talking has come in about, we need to control tech companies so they can't censor voices, right? Because they're violating the First Amendment. Well, we're all violating the First Amendment. And I don't mean constitutionally, I mean by that logic, right? We're all violating by saying this is what you can talk about and this is what you can't talk about. For instance, when you're talking about a YouTuber in Texas cannot talk about the effectiveness of masks, shouldn't they be the ones talking about it? Right? If we have 50 states and each of them have different ways of approaching a pandemic, for instance, isn't there value in YouTubers, tweeters, Instagrammers, Snapchatters, TikTokers, whatever platform you want to use? What is it? OpenStack? Substack? What is it, the thing that Dr. Thompson posts on?
I think Substack, I think it's the name.
Substackers, right? Substackers. Whatever platform you want to use. Isn't there value in you saying, we're handling it this differently? We're handling this thing differently, and this is what it's like on the ground where we are? Isn't there a value in that?
Our fact checkers have determined no.
Well, and that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying the lack of conversation. And that's ultimately the bigger problem here. And that's why I'm saying we need to start deciding for ourselves whether to wear a mask or not. Because we have to have that conversation. Good is a conversation. And I find that so fascinating when you talk about YouTube and our fact checkers, because you saw the same thing from Gavin Newsom's reaction to the governor of Texas. Did you see his tweet?
No. What did he tweet? I can't wait.
He quote tweeted the Associated Press talking about Texas lifting its mask mandate, making it the largest state to end an order intended to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. And Gavin Newsom just retweeted it, absolutely reckless. Because he doesn't intend for this to be a conversation. He's never intended for this to be a conversation. He's never intended to listen to his people. He just wants to portray anyone who disagrees with him as absolutely batshit insane and irrational. And that's the scary thing.
Well,
that's the scary
thing. In their mind, letting people decide their own actions is reckless. Right? That is part of that mindset.
Right. Right, because we can't decide for ourselves. It's the idea that we're all stupid. And that's the greatest fear I have for our country in general, our culture in general, is everybody thinks they have the right perspective. And they're totally dishonest with us. And the reason I know they're totally dishonest with us is, did you see, you know, on one hand, Gavin Newsom said this. But on the other hand, did you see what he said?
No.
Starting on April 1st. And this is from the OGC Register. Starting on April 1st, California theme parks can reopen at 15% capacity in red/substantial tier 2, 25% capacity in the orange/moderate tier 3, and 35% capacity in the least restrictive yellow/minimal tier 4. Now, it's still going to be, attendance will be limited to California residents. There'll be different guidelines as far as, you know, indoor rides and things like that. But if he really believed that this was still an issue and there were problems, would he actually reopen theme parks? Theme parks of all things.
Yeah.
Or
crazy.
Well, it's crazy because he knows. He knows he's losing a PR battle right now. He's keeping his state closed and Florida and Texas are open.
Dude,
what
I went surfing.
What the fuck does that look like?
I went surfing yesterday, and first of all, there's some crazy people that were like riding their bike or roller skating with masks. But otherwise, all along the strand, I didn't see anyone wearing a mask. They were all sort of, I guess, quote unquote, exercising. And then the beach just had the normal amount of people for a, you know, winter day out in Hermosa. It was just, you know, people out sneaking their booze out under their umbrella, right? Enjoying the beautiful, beautiful afternoon sun. Like, It seemed a lot more normal than it has in the past.
Yeah, because people do not believe this anymore. What have we seen, William? We have seen continually things change, and then they tell us, they being the CDC, governor, plural, the media, tell us that nothing has changed, the pandemic's still going on. Oh, yeah. You can get a vaccine, but you still have to wear a mask. At a certain point, people are reasonable enough that they're going to wake up to that. Are they not?
I would hope so. I mean, even the teachers unions are starting to lose their fights, right? The ones that are refusing to teach kids in person until they get the vaccine. They're even losing that argument now.
Well, why shouldn't they when I'm teaching every day in class?
Well, but that's Florida, and you're just like Texas. You're reckless or whatever Newsom said.
You know what? Absolutely reckless. Is that what he said? Let me double check. I can't remember what he said because he says so many insane things, so I have to check Twitter. Yeah, absolutely reckless. I'm going to take that on as a new moniker. The Midside, absolutely reckless. But William, that's my point with this whole theme park reopening thing. Isn't it so transparent? Because to me, here's the thing. If even California's reopening theme parks, even at 15%, and that's a concession to me, that's a concession. That's him saying, I can't really keep this stuff closed anymore. I'm just going to give you a little bit to keep you happy because I know I'm losing. So I have to satiate you somehow so you don't basically put me in the guillotine. Right? It's like a rich guy throwing crumbs to the crowd. He threw some coins out to keep them from riding.
I want you to make your point, but come back to, I can't imagine this working. That will be my lead-in after this.
Well, you've already, I mean, I should probably just let you talk because that's my entire point.
I can't imagine this working. A theme park occupancy and how the monetary business structure works, they've been closed for how long now? And you're going to let them open at 15%? How do you not operate at a loss at 15%?
Right. And then you're going to see Disney World operating, and you're going to see Texas open and South Dakota open and all these other states open. If he lets them open at 15%, they're just going to go, why not just let us operate more? And how are you going to go in there? This is one of those things that's disconnected from reality, William. How do you go in and make sure they're only at 15% capacity? Now, Disney can monitor the number of people they have in there, and they can be required to report that. But at what point do you enforce this, and how do you enforce it? Do you enforce this that they're at 20%, you fine them a certain amount of money? If they're at 50%, you fine them a certain amount of money? Do you send the police in there? This is why I'm saying it's a concession, right? Because if it's you fine them a certain amount of money, all they're going to do is look at what's the inflection point of the fine versus the number of people we get in there, makes it so we're still making money. And plus, they're also going to factor in possible lawsuits, blah, 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 right? We have to, you know, the liability in there as well. I understand that, because somebody might sue if they catch COVID. That's why it's the reason I'm convinced Disney World's not 100% open. But that's why I'm saying this is a signal to me that the pandemic is over.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been over forever for me, for a long time. But that we all know it's over now, because the mandates are coming down, and even California is getting rid of the guys that we need to keep things closed. Because what's the difference, William, as you're saying, between 15% and 50% for Disneyland? What's the difference?
It's just whether they...
It's just... go ahead.
Whether they actually make money or not might be the only difference.
No, I agree with that from Disneyland's perspective. But I'm saying from Gavin Newsom's perspective, from everyone else's perspective, it's just a number to make us feel like it's being safe. Why 15%? Why not 20? Why not 10? Where did 15 come from? Where are these numbers coming from?
And what does capacity even mean? Yeah, what does capacity even mean in this context, right?
Right.
Like, capacity means something. It's a business term, you know, that for something like a theme park, right? That's capacity is like, they know that there's a certain amount of people that it just will lead to churn, right? And that's really what capacity is. I mean, there's a capacity above that too, I'm sure, that has to do with safety and evacuation and things like that, right? But there's a capacity meaning like, this is your target amount of people that can be in there in order to, you know, allow people to interact with the rides enough, you know, interact with the vendors enough, that sort of stuff.
Right. Maximize their enjoyment so that you get the maximum amount of profits. It's a trade-off between the amount of, this sounds so negative, but the amount of suffering people are willing to endure for their
enjoyment. Yeah, the line. Exactly.
Well, that's what I mean. The line, part of it is, what do you set the prices at? Right. Because you can raise capacity if you lower prices a little bit.
Oh,
you can raise capacity if you have more rides, right? Once they open up Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway up in Toontown, well, they can raise capacity. They've even said this, because if you keep a bunch of people in line there, which opens up the other lines, well, you've got more people in the park because they're willing to wait for that ride, which opens up the enjoyment for everybody else. I mean, wasn't that the theory behind Star Wars Land? We can raise capacity because there are people in there, and then we'll give them their boarding groups where you can only go into Star Wars Land. This is in Disneyland at a certain time, which will then increase business to the rest of the park. And people are probably willing to put up with more lines in the rest of the park because they know they'll get into Star Wars Land later. So all of these things factor in. Do they get to raise capacity when Marvel Avengers Campus opens? Oh, well, 15% capacity there is more because more people want to go and are willing to put up with stuff. So the pandemic's over. So we need to move on to worrying about other more important things, like app icons. I don't know how much I have to say about this, William, but this might seem more like a thing you could say. I'm just going to ask you, when you looked at the old Amazon icon, did you ever think of Hitler?
No, I was, you remember back when we were like in, I guess it must have happened maybe in junior high, when they started having those diagrams you would look at, and they had the multiple colors, and if you like squinted and crossed your eyes enough, you could see a 3D image. I felt like it was one of those where I was struggling to see what they were seeing.
I think those are called magic eye. I think they're stereoscopic is what they are.
Yeah. So I felt like it was one of those stereoscopic images, and I wasn't just, I was just not getting it. I was not seeing the tiger. And yeah, cause there was a bunch of them that were tigers back then. It looked like a tape. It's a schooner.
A schooner is a sailboat. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Oh man. So yeah, I didn't see it, but hey, they responded quickly, redid it and made a squiggly tape line, a straight tape line. I don't know. I don't get it, but I mean, you know, Amazon secretly wanted to, I guess, support white nationalism. I don't get it. I mean, wasn't shutting down Parler enough to prove that they're not into white power, according to their logic?
I don't think there is logic. I think it's emotionalism. It reminds me of something that I heard Dr. Drew say on the Adam and Dr. Drew show. He said, like, you know, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, if somebody came into his practice or came into the psychologist practice and said they saw Nazis and white supremacists everywhere, they would be diagnosed with delusions. But now everyone sees them everywhere. And this goes back to like stuff I said when like James Gunn got in trouble for his pedophilia tweets, right? His jokes about pedophilia. And I said, who thinks these things, right? Who comes up with a joke like that? It's only somebody who has that stuff on their minds. And I'm not saying that James Gunn is a pedophile, but at the very least, he's trained his brain to make jokes about pedophilia. Why? I don't know. Maybe he just thought it was funny. But the point is, he only comes up with it and sees that angle because he's trained his brain that way over time. This just shows, William, the danger of training your brain over and over again to see certain things that aren't a danger.
So it's like we're in one of those ghost hunter reality shows, you know, where they see ghosts everywhere. Everything is evidence of ghosts. So everything's evidence of white supremacy. Even an Amazon app icon.
Right, even worse than that, everything's a symbol of Hitler, of yeah. Nazis. Sorry, yeah. I was trying to repeat what you said. I couldn't remember the word you said. But yeah, that's exactly what it is. I mean, look, I can almost understand.
We were all 12 years old and drew penises and saw penises everywhere, right? I mean, that's a juvenile thing, right? Like, oh, that looks like a cock, right?
I mean, that's seen in Superbad, right?
Yeah. So is that, are we all just in Arrested Development?
Well, I think it is Arrested Development to a certain extent. I really do think it is. I think you're arresting your brain's ability to perceive reality properly by fixating on these things. And like I was saying, I can understand a little bit to be like concerned about racism and white supremacy, but to specifically worry about Nazis all the time, specifically Nazis. Like, why is that the form of white supremacy? Do people know that white supremacy would take other forms?
Here's the thing. Nazis to the left, this might be a controversial. Nazis to the left is the fucking, like, reptile people on the right. It's the same level of irrationality and conspiracy. Right?
Right, except we've made it normal to fucking look at Amazon and be like, imagine if you looked at Amazon, you were like, oh, that's a lizard tongue. They're controlled by the lizard people, and then they had to change their icon. People
we need to like, start a meme nuts. With the new icon being something about the Illuminati. Midsiders, get on that.
All right, so the new icon is the Illuminati.
And yeah, you know, somehow. I don't know how, but it's there.
It's interesting you say this, right? Because this actually links to the next thing I wanted to talk about. Because something I've been reflecting a lot about, because it came up again, because Zack Snyder's Justice League is coming out in about, like, you know, about 2 weeks, right? It's a little under 2 weeks when we're recording this and when you're listening to this episode. Or maybe you're listening to this on a Thursday and it's 1 week. Or maybe you're listening to this a week late and it's in a couple days. But the point is, Zack Snyder's Justice League is about to come out. So, of course, the takes of Zack Snyder as a fascist are coming up again, right? And this to me is the same thing. William, before we even get into why and my theory as to why and pitching it to you, I want to ask you, has there ever been a time you watched a Zack Snyder movie and you thought there's anything fascist in these movies?
I can't recall any. I mean, Snyder hasn't had a ton of things to do, like, with the government itself, right? It's all seemed extra government in that way. But I don't know, fascism, I usually think of like really gross conformity, right? And sort of like, I guess hero worship and sort of like showing deference to the state. Right? I'm trying to think of like old Russian or German World War II era movies, you know? No, I can't see a lot of comparisons there.
Well, it's interesting you did that, right? Because you actually walked into my point without me expecting you to. You helped me. What you just spoke to was your emotional reaction to the idea of fascism, right? You're not talking like the denotative definition. You're talking about your connotations with the word fascism, which is really interesting because you talked about like fealty to the state, fealty to the government, things like that, fealty to a group of people. But let's look at the definitions of fascism, because this discussion, I think, is not just relevant to Zack Snyder, and we'll connect it to one of our favorite thinkers in a moment, but I think it's relevant to our culture as a whole. So I found that Merriam-Webster had the best definition of fascism, and there are two of them here, and I think that's...
Orange Man is the first one.
No. That's why I think Merriam-Webster had the best definition. There's two of them. One is the literal philosophical political definition, and the second is more of a general personality definition. And that's the reason why I like the Merriam-Webster one, because it's split into two, and what you just said, that when you look at a lot of them nowadays, they'll say fascism is a right-leaning ideology, which I disagree with completely. I believe in the political circle, William,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Where you go far enough right or left, you still end up in fascism.
Yep.
So fascism, number one definition, often capitalized. A political philosophy, movement, or regime, such as that of the fascisti, I don't know how you say that, that exalts nation and often race above the individual, and that stands for a centralized autocratic government headed by a dictatorial leader, severe economic and social regimentation, and forcible suppression of opposition. Now, I love that definition because it gives criteria, it gives a abstract philosophical underpinning, and also talks about what the concrete manifestations of it would be, and it does not ascribe it to right or left. I think that is a pretty objective definition of fascism. What do you think?
Yeah, I like it.
All right, so Merriam-Webster, guys, let's use that dictionary from now on. Ah, but what I just did, William, when I said let's use that definition, let's use that dictionary, did I just do something fascist? And that's my point. Let's look at the seven. No, you laugh, but I think people see it that way. Let's look at the second definition. A tendency toward or actual exercise of strong autocratic or dictatorial control. Now, it doesn't say from who. It just says a tendency toward or actual exercise of strong autocratic or dictatorial control. Now, what do we always talk about on the show? Or what do I always talk about? One of the underpinnings of Marxism is the idea that there's always the oppressor and the oppressed. So if you look at it from that perspective, isn't there always a fascist and a non-fascist? And let me make this more explicit. Let's move beyond the Marxist thing. Something I talked about on the show before is the idea that they're trying to make externalities a thing for our moral lives and our everyday decisions. Because if you make that a thing, externalities make it so individualism is not possible. Because every choice you make limits somebody else's choices. So if you strongly limit, or if you strongly make decisions and you strongly stand for what you believe in, and you are self-realized and self-actualizing, then you are necessarily limiting somebody else's options.
Yeah, at least I would say yes in that sense. I mean, I would definitely say that's not limiting other people's options, because that's not an option. You can't force other people to do things, right?
You've already jumped to the end here where they're wrong. But yeah, they're saying it is force.
Yeah,
because you're taking things away from them because they don't have a say in the decision.
Right.
If you decide, let me be very explicit here. If you decide you're going to train a certain way for wrestling, and that makes it so you win the championship, that's not fair, because you didn't all decide together how you were going to trade, how you were going to train. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. It obliterates, in like you said, it obliterates individuality if all external, like if you start with any identifiable or even made up external thing, like you were saying, then you can't have any individual choices because your choices, quote unquote, affect everyone, right?
Correct. And but I
that's,
think this
but
is
that's
why...
saying that's saying your choices impact reality is what that really boils down to. And so that's why you can just discard it, right? Well, of course, individual choices affect reality, right? So otherwise, why would we choose, right? It's sort of inverting cause and effect in that way. It's saying because causes have effect, you have to give up your individuality. You just have to reject that.
100%. And that's why I think people see Zack Snyder movies as fascist. Because I think
because his causes have effects.
But its causes have effects, and he shows people making decisions based on their own values that have effects on other people. Yeah. When you look at Superman, people see his Superman as fascist, which is insane to me, right? Because he's not forcing anyone to do anything. But when they see he gets to decide who lives and who dies, and he does make that decision, they see that as fascist. Because he's
he should have
choices.
Held a vote or something, right?
Right. Now you get it. And I don't think people are explicitly thinking these things I'm saying, but I'm thinking they're having that emotional reaction to it. A self-empowered Superman who gets to decide, oh, I'm going to save Lois, I'm going to save these people. And he's not limited by government action. He's not limited by what everyone says. I think that scares them, and they see that as fascist. And that's the emotion, that's the word they assign to the emotion. And I think this comes out in many things in our society. And William, I think this also applies to Ayn Rand. When they see a character like Howard Rourke or John Galt, they see a John Galt as a fascist. They see a Howard Rourke as a fascist. Because imagine what Howard Rourke does and does in that book. And how that's limiting to other people. Oh, well, why can't they get the houses they want? Why does he have to design the house the way he wants? That's a fascist point of view.
Yeah.
Don't I sound like them now?
Yeah. I think you've channeled them properly.
So does this make sense? Have we explained this phenomenon?
I hope so. Folks should hop into Discord and we can continue this conversation.
Yeah, let's continue to have this conversation in the Discord. I think this is a very important conversation, but I think we've cracked the code. I think there are two different uses of fascism, and I think it's important that we don't allow this to happen, and we have this conversation.
Yeah.
Because these mean two different things. Now, to be clear, I don't think Merriam-Webster intended it with their second definition, but I think it's become the emotional reaction. And that's why people call everything fascist.
I think it makes a lot more sense now.
By this, capitalism is fascist. Because when they sell you a product, they're deciding what product you get. That's fascist.
And when you buy it, other people can't have it.
And so your act of buying it is fascist.
Yep.
All right, on that note, let's move on to talk about other things that people probably call fascist in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. As William said, if you would like to continue the conversation about this use of the word fascist, you can do so in our Discord. We love our Discord. We're building a great community in there. Probably a community of fascists. I don't know why I said that. I probably just got us canceled. Whatever. You can join it at themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast. Just click on any episode link, and there should be a join link there for the Discord channel. William, did I hear you have a reaction there?
I said, oh, no.
Well, something people might have said, oh, no, about is the reboot of Karate Kid or the sequel series. I remember way back in the day, I had that reaction. I was like, this looks terrible. This is stupid. And then I watched it, and anyone who's followed me on Twitter or followed the show knows that I absolutely love the Cobra Kai series. And I was able to finally finish season three this past week. And I have to say that season three turned it around for me. And what I mean is, I would probably rank the seasons 1, 3, 2. Wasn't as big of a fan of 2, although the ending to 2 is tremendous. I still think 1 is the best, although I saw it years ago. It would be, you know, I'd probably have to rewatch it, but it'd be hard for me to say it's not the best. It's almost like these seasons of these series at this point are like different books, where they can work as standalones, but they work well together as well. Like, you could see this past season being like a standalone season, where it's like, okay, you know, it's sort of a cliffhanger, but it's not really. The same thing with last season, right? Season 2 could have been like a tragic ending. Season 3 is more of like a happy ending. And season 1's definitely like a happy ending. And there are some threads, but, you know, it doesn't matter because life has threads. So they're almost like books. So it's like comparing a book you read years ago. But as far as season 3, what it especially turned around was its own season. And I know, William, you're on about episode 8. But for me,
I just checked. I finished episode 8. I'm on episode 9.
Okay, so you're about the part where the season starts turning around. I think 9 is the one where Allie comes back, is it not?
I don't know. I haven't started at 9.
Well, what happens at the end of 8?
The tournament's being canceled. So they're all dealing with, you know, the fact that they go to the council and make the argument to bring the tournament back.
So, right, they all make the arguments. But I think the end of 9 is... Or the end of 8. Yeah, the end of 8's... Yeah, 9's the Allie episode. So yeah, you're getting to the point now where the season really starts to turn itself around. And what I mean by that is, what I love about Cobra Kai, William, is that it's the story of Johnny Lawrence. I like the Johnny Lawrence character the best. I think he's a character we need in today's day and age. I think what they're doing with him is they're trying to show the need for masculinity without showing what actual toxic masculinity by showing what actual toxic masculinity is by contrasting him with Sensei John Kreese. And I think he's a great character. But halfway through season 3, they decided, they were like, you know what, we're going to make this show about Daniel again, and we're going to make Johnny Lawrence the B story. And I guess maybe they thought that it was more interesting that way because, you know, Johnny Lawrence's story was helping Miguel become unparalyzed again.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting over that. And that sort of feels like a plot mechanic based upon the end of season 2. And, you know, it was also him realizing, you know, that he really is a sensei and he really is a teacher, which, you know, as someone teaching and coaching now, that kind of hit me really hard. But it was like they didn't really think that was the important story, where to me, that was the more interesting story.
Yeah. To push back a little bit on that, I think there you could end up with that being like a soap opera trope if, like, you know, in episode 1 he's paralyzed and in episode 2 he's healed, right? Like, so there's a sense they have to give it some time, right?
No, 100%. That's why they did it, and I thought they paced that part well.
I think,
but I'm talking about the design of the episode. Like, why was the primary of every episode Daniel going to Japan and trying to save his dealership? Something I ultimately did not give a fuck about. Did you have that reaction to that?
Well, I saw it more about his marriage than his dealership. So that's interesting. That's interesting to me. Not that saving, sort of like saving the dealership because they connected it to their marriage, right? And, you know, this ongoing conflict of him finding balance, right? To me, it all united to that theme of finding balance. So to me, it was like two contrasting stories, and definitely the A story was about him investing back time and energy into his business, but then also that because he's doing that, also gaining more insight into karate and that value, right? Like the whole thing of, hey, seeking balance leads to these things, right? That was sort of the A theme. And then the B theme was about, you know, recognizing yourself, right? And then him seeing Johnny Lawrence finding the balance and teaching about the balance of that sort of healthy masculinity that he's trying to aim for, right? That he's trying to put into words.
Right. So I think you hit the keyword balance. I think that's the overall theme of the season, more so than the first two, right? So the first one was all about the value of the masculinity. The second one was all about the dangers of the masculinity, about taking it too far. Whereas the third one is about finding that balance. And now I think the fourth one is going to be, how do you defeat the unhealthy masculinity once you found that balance? And then I don't know where they're going to go. There's supposed to be six seasons they have planned out. I'm hoping that, you know, maybe it takes them five seasons. Maybe it takes them six seasons to defeat Cobra Kai and Sensei Kreese. But I'm hoping that once they beat him, we're going to finally redeem Johnny, because I don't think he's been fully redeemed yet. And that's where I hope the series ultimately goes. That, you know, I don't think the final stop on this show's battle is defeating John Kreese. I think it's redeeming Johnny Lawrence. So I'm hoping that's where it goes. But that's, again, with that being the overall arc, that's why I didn't enjoy it as much this season. I don't want to redeem Daniel LaRusso. I don't think he needs to be redeemed. And I think, like, him having a little bit of an identity crisis isn't an interesting conflict to me. Like, his story was the Karate Kid. This is Johnny Lawrence's story. Do you get where my critique is coming from?
I do. I think what I would caution is we should see where it's going, because Daniel was out of balance and he was brought back into balance, right? And I think that motion of his character helps set us up for resolution with Johnny, right?
So, right, and you haven't seen the last two episodes of the season.
So,
I mean, this is a thematic spoiler. I won't tell you what happens, but that's the overall arc of the season. And I said that halfway through. I tweeted it, and I was like, if all this focus on Daniel's journey and making hit the A story doesn't end with him realizing he needs to work with Johnny to defeat Kreese, then it's a waste. And that's ultimately what happens in the season. I'm not going to tell you how it happens, because the way it's done is great, right? And it sets up season four very well. And that's it. Look, to me, William, that is the real mastery of the Cobra Kai series. Yeah. I think these writers are so technically proficient. They know where they're going. They know what their themes are. And they're able to execute it in a way that, even though you know what's going to happen, right? And this is one of the biggest arguments in our culture right now with art. Everyone wants art to be surprising. Right, in Survivor,
subvert expectations, baby.
Right.
Rian Johnson.
Right, exactly. The Last Jedi, right? Oh, they subverted expectations, so it's good. And like I said, with Survivor, oh, we want to blindside every episode. We don't want to see who's being voted out. Whereas my favorite season of Survivor is the one where you know who's going to win. It becomes obvious, and you see how he executes it, and you see what the story is being told as to how he's doing it. What does it mean? What does it reflect about the human condition that he's able to do this? It's the same thing with Cobra Kai. It shows what good writing is. Good writing is, it doesn't matter if you know what's going to happen. It's in the how. It's in the execution. And to me, that's what Cobra Kai is. I was able to call that halfway through. I was saying, this is the best way to write this story.
Yeah.
And they did it, and it executes it well. And that's why I enjoy Cobra Kai. You know what the story is. They know how to tell it. And that's crazy to me that it's that good. And you want to know what's crazier, William?
What's that?
I looked up the producers. Do you want to know what other stuff they worked on before Cobra Kai?
What did they work on?
This is the guy who wrote Hot Tub Time Machine. And he works with the guy who did the Harold and Kumar series.
Hey, Hot Tub Time Machine was funny. I don't like comedies, and I thought it was funny.
That's a funny movie. It's a smart movie. Harold and Kumar is a funny franchise. But what does it say about our society that that's where our good writers are being placed in right now? And they gave them, you know, Cobra Kai, and they're like, okay, you can do that franchise. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's sitting at 90% with the audience on Rotten Tomatoes right now. Season 3 is. That's
great.
Damn amazing, right?
Especially, I think other people who love the original Karate Kid will like it more because of all the time it spends with Daniel, and it goes back into a lot of the Japanese plot from Karate Kid 3. So You'll enjoy it if you're really a big Karate Kid fan. I was never a huge Karate Kid fan. Like, everyone grew up watching The Karate Kid, right? I mean, everyone, like, rubbed their hands together. Do you remember that when you were a kid? You rub your hands together, got warm, and you placed it. You're like, now you feel better. And everyone did wax on, wax off.
Yep.
All right. So, you know, we're all Karate Kid fans, but there are some people who will love it a lot more because of that. And then there are other of us who are Johnny Lawrence fans. So you should watch Karate Kid, or you should watch Cobra Kai if you're alive. Can you think of any reason to not watch it, William?
If you hate karate.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there is a lot of overlap, too. I realize there's like a lot of overlap with wrestling and the things they teach and everything. It's pretty crazy. Okay, we're going to roll into Trailer Takedown now. I was not able to post the trailers this week because of the state wrestling tournament, which took up a lot of my time. But usually I post them on Saturday on the website. But I have a new idea for you, William. I want to pitch this to you. What if I always just put the trailers for Trailer Takedown in the Discord channel?
I think that would work. We got our fans in the Discord channel, so they can all watch it.
And if you want the trailers and want to know what we're talking about ahead of time, you should join the Discord. So I think from now on, I'm just going to put the trailers in the Discord channel. Now, every trailer I put in Discord, does it mean we're going to talk about it? No. But I will only talk about we will only talk about a trailer on Trailer Takedown if it's in the Discord channel. And that gives you the opportunity. If you would like to watch it before the episode, go ahead. If you'd like to watch it after the episode, go ahead. If you'd like to listen to the episode and pause every time before we talk about a trailer, you can do that as well, because they will be in the Discord channel.
Trailer Takedown.
First trailer.
Without Remorse is an Amazon Prime movie starring Michael B. Jordan. It's based on a Tom Clancy book, and to me it looks like a cross between John Wick and Jack Ryan. And I say that with the highest possible compliment. Does it look as good as John Wick? No. I haven't seen Jack Ryan, but Jack Ryan looks pretty good. It's by Carlton Cuse. It's on my list. So is it as good as Jack Ryan? I don't know. But it looks very, very good. And honestly, the main thing that will keep me from watching this is I don't have Amazon Prime. Still going to figure out what I'm going to do about The Expanse when we do our Expanse episodes. But yeah. I think this looks really good. And William, I think this is an example of how colorblind casting can work. You know, we have all of this talk nowadays about, like, we need more movies with minority leads and minority characters, and we need to capture the minority experience. I think this is a movie that shows it doesn't matter what the race of the main character is. Cast based on who you think would do the best. And I think Michael B. Jordan looks great in this role. Cast who you think would do the best, and it'll be a human movie. And for that alone, I think this movie deserves a hug.
Hug.
Yeah, it's got explosions. It's got some decent visuals, I think. And then, yeah, of course, I'm going to watch this movie. It looks like a lot of fun. Probably a Friday night Netflix and chill. And Justin, well, I think I can hook you up with some Amazon Prime. So.
Oh, well, now we figured out the Expanse thing, so.
Exactly. So I'm definitely going to hug this.
Hug! Second trailer.
The Rookies is a Mila Jovovich action comedy. I don't really know what this movie is. It looks low budget. It looks in the style of the Resident Evil movies. I'm not going to say it looks bad, because it's pretty much what you would expect from a Mila Jovovich movie in today's day and age. I was with this until the weird scene with her with, like, the acupuncture needles in her head. That really broke the tone for me and didn't make any sense. So I worry that this movie is going to be very disjointed. If somebody was like, hey, I want to watch this, or if it was on and I had nothing else to do, which rarely ever happens nowadays, I would watch it. But otherwise, it just doesn't seem like it's going to be executed with a high enough quality. It looks very all over the place. Tackle?
Yeah, when I watched this, I had two thoughts simultaneously in my head. One was, this looks interesting visually, and the budget for this was too low. Does that make sense, Justin? Like, I was like, oh, these are some interesting shots. And then it sort of, like, knocked me out, like, ew, that's some really bad CGI.
That's you captured it very well. I had those simultaneous thoughts as well.
Yeah, so I think I would sit this one out because there are just other more interesting things I'd like to catch up on, like playing more Uncharted 4. So I'll tackle.
Final trailer.
Voyagers is a sci-fi movie starring Colin Farrell. No, it is not a reboot of Star Trek Voyager, although it sounds like it from the title. Maybe that's just my Star Trek fandom coming out from my childhood. In this movie, they're on a journey across space. I don't know to where, but the passengers, the astronauts on the ship are made to take this blue liquid that apparently numbs them to all pleasure, all sensation. I think sort of like the movie Equilibrium with Christian Bale, if you've ever seen that, where he can't experience any emotions. I think they make them take pills or something. I don't remember. I saw it years ago. But that movie reminded me of Fahrenheit 451. But similarly, in this movie, they take this and it like numbs them to all pain, all sensation. And then they start to decide not to take it. And the effects are dangerous, of course, because if you don't have any sensation, then you have sensations. That's going to be insane. Like they have a small scene of somebody like intentionally shocking themselves right on the hand. But here's the thing. I have two questions about this movie, or two thoughts about this movie. One, why does it take place on a spaceship? It seems like maybe that's done to make the scope smaller for budget reasons. And that's, you know, an unfortunate reality of movie making. This seems like it may have been better as a book premise where you could show different effects throughout the world and on human life on Earth. Whereas it's sort of like, oh, well, let's set this on a spaceship so it doesn't really endanger all of the human world and there aren't the greater implications for society as a whole. And, you know, we can end this tragically with only losing the lives on the ship. And I say that because my second observation is at the end there was a line, and I can't remember the line 100% now, but it was basically saying, like, is this what humanity is or something like that? And insinuating that humanity is depraved and that if you allow humans to have sensations and have pleasure, then they will just act in a depraved manner. So based upon that sort of line and the sense I get from the scope of the rest of the movie, I think that this is one of those movies that's going to act pseudo-intelligent by talking about how the human condition is suffering and that humans are, you know, ultimately immoral. And for that reason, I am going to tackle this.
Tackle.
You know, I get excited for new sci-fi stories. So that alone makes it interesting to me.
Yeah, William, I was excited when they started showing the blue stuff and they were saying, yeah.
The fake Falcon Heavy rocket sensations that they were, you know, launching on. Yeah, all that stuff looks interesting. But I worry about the theme here too. I don't know. For some reason, this could be just me reading in sci-fi things, right? But I was thinking, oh, is this like a generational ship, right? Like, are they going somewhere? Is that why they're taking the blue liquid, right?
I think so. I think you're right.
So, but yeah, this could go, this is like on a knife's edge as far as where the theme could go, right? So I think I'm willing to give it a try, but I will happily abort the movie if it's terrible. So this is a Netflix and hug.
Netflix and hug.
All right, that brings us to the end of our episode. Let's put a bow. Let's wrap it up. William, what did you learn?
Well, I learned that the Midside has the power to declare the pandemic over. Justin, what did you learn this trip?
I learned that with that power comes the realization that I am a fascist, because now I understand the proper definition and use of the term fascist. We'd like to thank all of you for supporting the show. As always, without your support, it would not be possible. Shout out to all our libertarian listeners. I think we had a pretty important discussion for libertarianism this week on the show. So thank you, liberty.me listeners. Of course, if you would like to continue to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. We talked about earlier Patreon and Locals, themidside.com/Patreon, themidside.com/Locals. You can also order my book, themidside.com/The Cut. The Cut is a novel. It's based on a true story of what happened behind the scenes of the principal photography of Justice League. And if you look at some of the articles that have come out recently, wow, it makes my book look a lot better. It makes me look like a genius. And I say that in the most humble way possible. I saw some of those quotes and I was like, wow, I look pretty good right now. All right, sweet. So you can always buy that, and I always appreciate that, and I appreciate if anyone actually enjoys it and tells me that.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am not a genius.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am a genius. Now you can put those back to back, William. I always appreciate anyone who reads it and is willing to talk to me about it. Thanks. That's pretty cool to, you know, make something you believe is art and have people want to engage with it. Same thing with this podcast. Like I said, if it wasn't for you, it would just be us screaming into a microphone talking to ourselves. And as always, that's the number one way you can support the show. Tell a friend. You want the show to grow? You want culture to become more rational? You want this pandemic to be over? Really over? You want everyone to understand the pandemic's over? Tell a friend. Tell them to listen to The Midside. This concludes your journey into The Midside. I'm Justin M. Wozeski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a pandemic-free day. So Justin, I signed up my puppy for some classes, some training classes, and it asked me for my puppy's Instagram.
Was that a required field?
It was a required field.
I have no comment.